Welcome to Talking Absolute Worship. I am joined by Peter, who works at Westminster Theological Training College for ministers in training and others who are looking to build skills for their vocations. So look them up on the internet. Westminster Cambridge offers several courses for different categories of people. And Peter's
your man. Or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And Peter, I am sure, has got a vibrant TikTok channel.
In your dreams, Phil.
Stuff dreams are certainly made of. Yeah. So welcome to our latest episode. We're going to be looking at the readings for Proper 15. There's only two of us this week, so blink and it'll be over. Between us, we'll try and just give you the germ of an idea to inspire ideas for preaching. And Peter's going to go first and steal all the best ideas and insights before I hoover up the crumbs under the proverbial table, of which more later. Peter, where do you think you're going to go?
Or, of course, it could be that Phil will correct my lack of theological insight and give you pearls of wisdom rather than crumbs from under the table. Well, here we go then, just with the two of us, so plenty of waffle to follow. I have chosen today Psalm 67, and then my main thinking is going to be based on the gospel reading of Matthew 15, which says 10 to 20. So I've altered that and I've gone with verses 1 to 20 of chapter 15. So I've added an extra 10 verses, as it just felt really weird to me to exclude the first 10 verses. I have no idea why the lectionary's chosen to cut it at that point, but you get half a story instead of the story. So I've gone for the first 20 verses. But let's start in Psalm 67, which is speaking of how, as the people of God, we should sing our praises to the Lord of the Lord in ways that will bear a rich harvest. And we'll have people all across the world recognizing and praising God, which is a pretty impressive picture to paint. What a world that will be. And yet, we then roll onto this Matthew reading, and the words coming out of people's mouths seem anything but those of praise and thanksgiving, if what Jesus is saying is anything to go by. So tricky to fit the two together, I thought, because they seem at opposite ends of the spectrum. But I think we'll look a bit more closely today at the passage for some ideas of how we might present these verses from Matthew. What we have here is one side of a conflict between church and synagogue, to me, in a particular situation at the end of the first century. And I think it's really important, if we're going to use this passage, and I'm thinking I will, to firmly implant in our minds, and even as we prepare it, in our minds, not just the congregation's minds, that we need to avoid simplistic caricatures of the historical Pharisees, or of portraying those of different theological outlooks in the colours of the Pharisees, because it's very easy to start to do that with this sort of passage. Every religious community needs its tradition. Now, some you'll find a damning of tradition, others adore it, but I think every religious community needs tradition as the vehicle for interpreting the word of God. No one has or can have the pure word of God, uncontaminated by human ideas or tradition. The treasure, in my mind, is always in clay pots. And it's really, really important for us to remember that. And I'm struck by the opening comments by the Pharisees, as only if you just take those opening words where you might be damning other Pharisees and read them. Only 4 years ago, we'd have seen this question of why do your disciples ignore the ceremonial hand washing as completely irrelevant to us. They would have had no bearing on how we think we are. And yet, COVID changed all of that. How did we view people would be a good question to ask. How did we view people who didn't use hand sanitizer or a face mask? Usually by not letting them in and viewing them as irresponsible or mad individuals. So is the question the Pharisees are asking so weird, so out of kilter? Would it have been something that we might have found ourselves asking? Because certainly over the last few years, we've asked it on more occasions than we probably care to remember. And I find it interesting that now, if you want to bring it up to date for a quick little illustration, I now find it almost irritating when I go to a doctor's and I'm told to sanitize and put the mask on. How quickly we forget what we were doing as something that really we thought was important. And now we think, for goodness sake, we're not doing it anywhere else. And suddenly it's, an irritant. So maybe, cut the Pharisees some slack here. They're asking for them a legitimate question. And I think that whole thing I've just said shows why context is so vital to understanding both actions and words. So let's not demonize the Pharisees for asking the question. And what follows offers us insights and thoughts for today. Because, firstly, in and through human tradition, Jesus and the early church were hearing the word of God in what was a fresh and definitive way. And the church of every generation needs to continue to listen for that new and fresh word from the Spirit rather than just depending on tradition. And I might want to develop the rest of the talk here. This is one way I might go. I haven't decided yet. Around we have been slow to listen, to adapt, and to display the freshness, relevance, and vibrancy of faith and of what God is doing in today's world and how we need to join in. So I might want us to think about, are we doing things in a particular tradition, in a particular way? Why? And a good opportunity to ask why and what are we missing? Because we can never say that God is not still at work, God is not still active, God is not still doing the new thing. And I can think of masses of examples of how God is doing a new thing. And maybe that's a challenge our churches need to be put before them. As has been said previously on Absolute Worship, I have a heart that looks for the pastoral, but maybe this is a week where I step out of that and challenge people with, are we a people who are failing to show and display the freshness of faith, the relevance of faith, and the vibrancy of faith? So that's one path I might go down this week. Should I choose not to? Then I'll continue into the meaning of holiness and what lies at the center, because that is really at the center of the reading. It is in the end holiness rather than ritual that God's looking for and will allow the people to raise their voices in praise as the psalmist declares. So we might want to think about, okay, what is holiness and how does holiness and bring us to the point of where back to the psalm and back to the psalmist's words. And we might want to do a comparison between what's being spoken about as ritual. So, what is ritual for us today alongside of what is the holiness God is calling us to, that the psalmist is declaring. And Jesus in Matthew is concerned for the intent of the heart and what comes out through the mouth. And the fear, I think, of defilement of our hearts, our minds, and our words is actually all around us. And to have an awareness of what is holy and what might defile, I know that's not a word we'd use a lot these days, but I think it's around, it's all around us, is absolutely vital. In the light of Jesus' teaching and example, Christians of every generation need to see themselves as belonging to a community that is called to holiness, and to ask in our generation what violates this holiness and nullifies the church's witness. So that's where you could sort of even bring holiness back to when I was just saying about going down the path of what is it in our witness that others see that is different, that's vital, that's alive, that they'd be attracted to. And maybe it's a lack of holiness, which is quite challenging, I think, for all of us if we say, well, actually, we're not living up to our calling of being a holy people. And I think a lot of people are scared of holiness, and holy people tend to be, you'll find it used a lot more, the word holy, in Orthodox settings, probably, than ours. But holiness is something, his holiness the Pope, for instance, that's actually often used in front of his name. So what do we mean by holiness? That's not about how we do things or style of worship. So I think this can be applied as much to pioneering fresh expressions settings or more traditional church and worship. It is the signs of holiness that will bind us to God and each other and be attractive to wider communities. And our vocation is to God's people in a secular and pluralistic world. So what sets us apart in order to serve in God's world would be a great question, I think, to ask people today. The debate and questions, therefore, to me, are just as relevant to us as they were in Matthew's situation that the Pharisees were teasing out with Jesus. And the answer really will make a difference. So that's where I'm gonna go.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for drawing out the words of caution about Pharisee bashing. There's a lot of Pharisee bashing goes on in the New Testament, but then is extended into the life of the church, and they become a convenient scarecrow to hit, don't they? When actually, often when you're considering these passages, the parallels to be drawn are not, oh, they're the bad Pharisees. It's actually, geez, the Pharisees would look very much like us, the established church leadership, who would be under attack rather than someone else. And so Pharisee bashing is kind of like bashing yourself a little bit if you're preaching, if you're involved in church leadership. A lot of Jesus's harshest words, and these are pretty harsh, were reserved for those who are involved in church leadership or religious leadership. To call them blind guides of the blind, I mean, perhaps we wouldn't use such insensitive language nowadays. But blind leaders of the blind is, that's pretty dismissive and pretty harsh. But it doesn't help the church to imagine there are Pharisees back then or elsewhere, no. Because the finger that Jesus is pointing is probably pointing at me. And I think we should usually take as our starting point the idea that Jesus is finger might be pointing at me. It wouldn't be the only place where it points. Obviously, there are messages and very, very strong messages in support of the poorest and most oppressed people in the world where Jesus' finger never points in that way. But in most of these passages, Western religious leaders are going to fall into the category of one being pointed at rather than cheering Jesus pointing at someone else. So anyway, yes, you've said that.
Chuck this out that maybe I remain unconvinced that Jesus doesn't point the finger at some of the poorest societies either.
Yeah, I said largely. I think maybe I didn't. You can rewind and see. But yeah, yeah, but Jesus is exactly. Yeah. But I think his harshest criticism comes at those who said it'd be better for you if you got thrown into a lake with a millstone around your neck. Yeah. Is that sort of language is never targeted at the poor and oppressed.
No.
And this kind of language that he's using here is never targeted at the poor and oppressed. Yeah, they have to shape their lives up too.
But this is aimed at, I mean, this is aimed very much at leaders. I think I'm struck several areas within Scripture where we're told, you know, punishment for you be twice as bad as it is for others.
Yeah.
If you're misleading my people.
Exactly.
And it is about leadership. Leadership comes with responsibility.
Yeah, there are people at the high end, not high churchmanship end, but the high end of preaching, who very, 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 very seriously address the issue of preaching being that kind of risky high calling. If you put yourself in that position, and it is a terrifying thing to do. There are some of us who are a bit more casual about it, and maybe shouldn't be. What an awesome responsibility it is to preach and lead people astray every week. There you go. So, yeah, word of caution there. But, yeah, I very much like your emphasis of holiness, and I think that is a word that congregations would find it helpful for you to unpack and to delve into a bit more, because it is an archaic sounding word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Largely because we've hived it off into negative phrases such as holier than thou. And if there's a phrase that Christians are accused of being more often than anything else, it's holier than thou, or hypocrites is the other one, isn't it? But holier than thou. And so
it's
as soon as we start
you saying that, Phil, I hadn't thought of that before, but I guess that's why when people say, oh, you're church, are you? I would never have guessed. Our first response is usually to say, well, we're just normal people like you, which at one level was the right answer. But we shouldn't get away from the fact we are actually being called to be something that a light shines from as well. So yeah, it's not about just being like, is it?
No, and it is about being holier than thou.
Yeah.
However,
I mean, bizarrely, it is.
It's not what people think when they say the sentence, is it? It's not what they mean.
No.
I suspect that a lot of Christians, I think probably myself included, nowadays prefer language about being countercultural rather than holier than thou. I'm holier than you are. But I don't think they're vastly different things to say. Countercultural sounds much more rad and hip, whereas I'm holy sounds like you sit in a room with a candle and your hands together all the time, which is the popular conception of being holy, isn't it? And anyway, so I think that's a fascinating question to unpack, particularly when coupled with these words about it's not what goes in the mouth, it's not what goes into a person that corrupts, it's what comes out of a person. And in a sense that we can all accept that's true, but it's also not true in another sense. I guess I'm not alone in having an experience of maybe just to take a light example, binge watching a whole TV series. So, because you can do it now, you can binge watch. So we watched, I forgot what it was called now, but a long running US cop series about a war, what they call the war on drugs in America. What was it called? I can't remember now. But it was very famous, and it was very long running and ran over several big budget seasons, as they call them in America. And if you binge watch that, and it comes in, it's what's coming in. It's what your eyes and your ears are absorbing from this constant binge watching. The language that's used, the attitudes that are expressed, the culture that pervades it, you can feel it beginning to change who you are and how you look at the world, in maybe very subtle ways. But I did find myself, because of the, I think sometimes it's to do with camera work. And if the camera works in a particular way and always looks, say, at a woman and looks at a woman in a certain way as a camera would and focuses in a certain way. And if you absorb that hour after hour after hour, I think it can change who you are. So, I mean, Jesus didn't binge watch Netflix, so maybe he didn't have this experience. But but I, whilst I think, yes, the Bible isn't a call to be immersed completely, I mean, to be separate completely from the world, the Bible is full of caution about not being polluted by the world. There's a slight grey edge, I think, to this question. Because I think it could easily be taken. So it doesn't matter what you eat, doesn't matter what you watch, doesn't matter what company you keep, it doesn't matter what you listen to, it doesn't matter what you absorb, that can't taint you. It's only what you say.
And that's where the aesthetics were known as holy men and women, where you get the idea of nuns and monks being holy because they've actually separated themselves. In order, and they were referred to as the holy people. And I think that's where we get this division with holiness, Phil, that somehow holiness, if I want to be a holy person, I'd have to take myself out of the world.
Yes.
And I think there's a remnant of that coming through even now in our thinking, isn't there?
I think there are church communities where people are encouraged only ever to listen to Christian music, only to listen to Christian radio stations, only to watch Christian films, only to read Christian books. And I don't think that's where Jesus is. But also, I don't think Jesus is saying, yeah, just do whatever the world does and it won't affect you, because the company you keep does affect you. So there's a considerable portion of grey. And I think Jesus is urging us to be way more bolder than we are. I mean, he was known as a party person, wasn't he? A drunkard who was always at parties. So I think perhaps we tiptoe across to the excluding ourselves side rather than the immersing ourselves side. But there's caution at both ends of this piece of string, I think. So there you go. I don't know where you go with that. But it could lead into a sermon about how do you live as a faithful, holy Christian whilst fully involved in the world? Do you become that po-faced person who, when anyone ever swears, they have to apologize to you because you're a Christian in the room? How much do you accept that if you're sat around a table and somebody is blatantly racist? What does that mean? That's far more courageous to be able to deal with that in a real-life pub situation than it is simply not to go there in the first place so you will never meet it. Like last week, only going in the shallows so you don't find yourself sinking in the storm and you need Jesus to save you. Anyway, that's not where I was going at all.
Well, we've run out of time now, so thanks for that, Phil.
Listeners all over the world, and indeed planet, will be scratching their heads thinking, oh no, Phil's got some more to say. I think I have decided where I'm going with these readings, and I'm picking it up from all of them in different ways. In Isaiah, it finishes, I will gather others to them besides those already gathered. This is the people coming back from exile. There's going to be far less of them around than there were before. If you wanted to get political about it, they're going to need immigration to do all the jobs, for one thing. But let's not go there. But you might want to draw your own conclusions about that. He's basically saying, open the doors. You're going to go into a land where people have moved in while you've been gone. Folk have moved in, and I am calling them to be under the umbrella. Interestingly, I think, and the umbrella is interestingly defined here. The umbrella isn't those who've been circumcised. The umbrella isn't those who adhere to a particular set of doctrines. The umbrella seems quite focused around keeping the Sabbath, which I just think is a really interesting emphasis you might want to draw out. What's being said there? It's the keeping of the Sabbath seems to be the thing. He said, if they respect the Sabbath, you know, welcome them into the fold. And not just offering hospitality to strangers. This is Isaiah going further than that and saying, no, they are fully within the family of God. So I think that's interesting. So that's an expansive passage where third Isaiah is preparing the people of Israel to say, this is bigger than you thought. God's umbrella has a larger circumference than you imagined. And there's room for all nations under that umbrella. And that becomes a dominant theme, I think, through third Isaiah, it's all nations being gathered to the mountain, all those kind of things. Psalm 67 has it too. Let the ends of the earth revere him, not just the tiny nation of Israel. The ends of the earth revere him. It's there in Romans where Paul appears genuinely anguished about whether God has rejected his people. Is God doing a new thing here? Has God left behind his chosen people? No, he says adamantly, in very, very forceful terms. God never leaves behind his beloved. It's there. It's like, all this stuff, about Gentiles. Does that mean he's forgotten us? Is it just because he's reaching out to someone else? Does that mean he's forgotten me? It's such a common human reaction, isn't it? You may even get it within families. You do something nice for one child. In other words, what about me? It's there in the prodigal son, isn't it? You're welcoming him back. What about me? I'm the older brother. And of course, many commentators say that's what the prodigal son is about, isn't it? It's the people of Israel saying, what about us? We've been here all the time. Are you leaving us behind for these new people you're gathering in under your umbrella? So Paul's wrestling with that. Have you forgotten us? What about us? Well, I'm an Israelite, and I don't think God has forgotten us, he says, reassuringly. And then Matthew, perhaps more controversially, we have this incident with the Canaanite woman, don't we? Jesus and his friends are not on home territory. They're in Gentile territory. And maybe the disciples are on alert, waiting for evil Samaritans to leap out on them and do something horrible. You are when you stray into territory that's not yours and you expect to be attacked at any moment. And they spot this woman. Jesus appears not to spot her at all or just to completely ignore her. And there are issues here. If you're going to read it, you probably need to deal with it. Jesus ignores her. He's tired. Yeah, that's fair enough. We all get tired. And then his silence, though, seems to be the best thing he does in this. because he moves on to insult her. And however many commentators try to soften this, William Barclay, I mean you, he meant cuddly little puppy. I'm not sure, because a cuddly little puppy is a nice thing, so he was just being charming. It's not cutting it for me. It might cut it for you. Good luck with that. I'm not having it, I don't think, trying to soften this. It was, I'm told by Palestinian scholars, it was a well-known insult from Jews to Samaritans, or to Gentiles, to call them dogs. It would be like calling people bitches nowadays. It has an impact, and it's not a cuddly word. So you kind of have to explain this exchange somehow, or you have to deal with it. You have to address it somehow. And there are various ways of dealing with it. Everyone will have their favorite way of dealing with it. One of those will be to try and soften what Jesus says and to make it into some kind of teasing banter. You could go down, and I have, when I was a younger preacher and felt the need to defend Jesus. I'm not really sure he needs my defense, but to defend him against this outrageous idea. I don't think I'd go down that route anymore. I think I would go down it's a fairly well-trodden route. I'm not telling you anything you probably haven't already heard. But that this encounter with this woman is for Jesus a teaching moment, which is exactly the same theme as is happening in Isaiah and in the Psalm and in Paul's letter to the Romans, that God's expansive vision and kingdom is bigger than even Jesus had at first imagined. And of course, that leads you into a discussion in your head about who Jesus is. If you accept with any force the idea that Jesus is fully human, then surely Jesus has to be teachable. If Jesus is not fully human and comes pre-packaged with everything he ever needed to know, that's a different view of Jesus than I think I have. And you'd have to find another way of dealing with it, which I'm sure there is. But good luck with that. I'm not going to be any help at all, I'm afraid. But I think this is a teaching moment, and I think it says something about who Jesus is, and more importantly, something about what it means to be Christ-like. Jesus allows himself to be schooled by a Canaanite woman, possibly the last person he expected to be schooled by was a Palestinian woman. But the fact that Jesus allowed himself to be schooled by this woman says something hugely important about who Jesus is. And more importantly, what it means to be Christ-like. Is being teachable Christ-like? Yes. Having enough humility to accept that an engagement with somebody else will bring you out being wiser and having learned something and having grown in the encounter, is that Christ-like? Yes. And if it is Christ-like, well, then here's Jesus modeling it. And here's Jesus showing us how to do it with grace. Rather than say, oh, stupid woman, and wandering off, which he could have done. And nobody would have thought any of the more, probably wouldn't even been written about, because it may be what they were expecting him to say. Stupid woman, leave me alone. Probably wouldn't even ever have been written down. He didn't. Jesus allowed himself to be taught, and he grew in the exchange. Not long before this, he was telling disciples to go out and not bother going to Samaritan villages. Don't bother going there. I'm just sending you to these places. And yes, he had limited time. That is also a factor here. He had probably a very specific thing to do with the time that he had. So he didn't heal everybody that came his way. He didn't have time for that. He had something to do. So you might want to use that as a kind of a softening approach to this. Jesus couldn't do everything whilst limited to time and geography and place and corporality. if that's even a word.
I think you're making a really important point, though, Phil, because the point is we often say about us being changed by our encounters with other people, but how much do we actually expect to be changed? I mean, do we enter those conversations and relationships expecting to be changed, or do we enter them from "we have something to teach you"? So I think you're making a hugely important point that if Christ could enter that and be challenged and changed by a conversation, surely we should always expect that to be the case.
Yeah. Well, yes, and probably it came out as more of a rant than a full sermon tip. But I know somebody within the URC who is perhaps the wisest, probably cleverest and most learned person that I am happy to call friend, and I am constantly impressed by watching her at work in situations where I know, comparatively speaking, she is sat listening to an idiot, quite often me. And she goes into those situations with people who she will inevitably disagree, and she knows in advance she will disagree. She is infinitely cleverer and more capable and more wise and more learned and more right, objectively so, than they are. And yet, my perception is that she always goes into those encounters looking to learn something new from them, looking to take something from them rather than primarily. Because I think, well, why is she going to this session? What on earth could she learn from this? And that's the answer. And it comes back to me, and I'm just no good at it, because I go into situations expecting to be, oh, well, I'm here to teach you something. Sit and listen. You'll be better for it. So there you go. And yet both of us, I'm sure we will all have this experience of being pastoral visitors, where we come out being the one who has been deepened and our breadth of knowledge widened by the interaction. So I get that some people will find this controversial, and I don't know, you have to judge your congregation about whether they will all throw a wobbly and leap out the window with horror if you suggest that Jesus needed teaching anything. Or that Jesus had ingrained within him from the culture, was what I was saying earlier on, that the stuff that sticks to you from the culture in which you grow up, that you imbibe through the skin, through your mother's breast milk, the culture that just seeps into you because you are constantly exposed to it. Jesus had that within him. And maybe this is one of those instances where it comes out and he just says this. And it's really ironic. And I wonder, what you said, why did they put these two together in the lectionary? Mm-hmm. Jesus has just said, it's what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. And what comes out of Jesus's mouth? You're a dog. Yeah. I remember Jesus is like, actually, what's going on here is, hang on, what have I just said? What did I say yesterday? Mm-hmm. It's what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. And there it is. Maybe that's going. I'm sure that's going too far for some congregations. Mm. So yeah, judge your audience, not judge in a bad sense, but judge them as in terms of what will be helpful for them to hear, or what they need to hear. Don't just be controversial for the sake of it. What has just come out of Jesus's mouth? Hang on, I would have hoped maybe a disciple would have intervened and said, hang on, Jesus, what was it you were telling us yesterday? What comes out of your mouth? But I imagine they were all the same. They'd already told her to clear off. So they weren't helping, were they? So, I think I'm going with that overarching theme of this is bigger even than Jesus thought it was, to begin with. God is doing a bigger thing. And you're on safe ground there, because God is always doing a bigger thing. God is always doing a bigger thing than we could possibly imagine. You're on well safe territory there. If you think you've contained what God is doing, and you understand it, then you've missed it, because God is always doing a bigger thing. And these are just instances of people realizing that God is doing a bigger thing. So there you go. Interestingly, and before I shut up, there are some skipped verses in Isaiah as well. It always draws the attention when there's some skipped verses. Verses 2 to 5 are missing. So this bit talks about everybody's in this tent. Everybody's under this umbrella. They're welcoming the foreigners. That missing bit says eunuchs as well. I don't know why the lectionary has chosen to remove them from the picture. Maybe that's just totally unacceptable that God would be welcoming the eunuchs. And it seems like a bit of an odd omission, particularly as it's not that long a passage. So somebody somewhere has taken the decision to remove the eunuchs from this God gathering in thing. So I think that broadens it. To say it's not just about race. It's to do about who you are, how you're identified by the society and the culture in which you live. You too are welcome. But yeah, some lectionary committee has decided that the eunuchs no longer have a place in this passage, whereas they did originally. So welcome back in, eunuchs. If you've been excluded from the passage, we can include them back in again if you wanted to expand the passage to include those five verses, which you really should do, in my humble opinion. So I think that's where I'm going preaching-wise. And obviously, because I'm on such a massive rant, there isn't any time for me to do anything else other than have a massive rant and preach. People. So I haven't got as far with thinking of creative, non-wordy ways of communicating the truths of these passages. So I was kind of hoping that you had, Peter.
Well, I want to reclaim the word holiness for this generation, because I think it's unhelpful to get rid. And so I want to do something around, in the Old Testament, it was very much about individuals being set apart to be holy, or things being set apart to be holy. So taking some dictionary definitions of holiness could be a good way of, well, where do you think this fits with our idea about holiness? I think you can argue, I looked up, you can argue that holiness in the New Testament is far more about restoration and regeneration of a moral universe. So that's quite interesting. So I thought, regardless of, I on this Sunday I looked, I will have children in the congregation, but I think whether they're children or adults, I'm going to do a holiness acrostic for everyone. And I thought I'd do this really early in the service. And I know some will take longer over it, and as we explore through the service, might like to fill it in more. So I'm not going to ask them what they've come up with early, but say, as things occur to you, fill it in. Because I think that could be really interesting to see the words that different people came up with in their understanding of what holiness is. So I think that's what I want to go down the path of. I'd also provide the opportunity for painting or drawing what people see as holiness rather than words, because not everyone works with words and would work better with image or a spider map or whatever it was. Find the best way you can. But I'd say by the end of the service, what we're looking to do is understand holiness for us as a congregation, regardless of age, how does it look, and so that we can think about how we go out and live it in the coming weeks. So I think for me, all of my stuff would be around that, and giving them different things to do during the service as we're discussing and talking and praying and singing and doing the stuff we do in worship, but actually getting it down, okay, what does it mean? That would be interesting, I think, to do if you had time and if you wanted less words in the talky bit, but still exploring would be really interesting to get them to fill it in at the outset of the service, therefore cutting out the time to do it then, and then get them to fill it in again towards the end of the worship and see what had changed, and then have time for discussion about what had changed and why it had changed in their understanding. So
If you
that would be
had
a more.
somebody who was quick with a laptop,
Yeah.
you could
Get it up off screen.
feed all the words that people had said in part one
Yeah.
into one of those, I don't know what you call them, but you know when
I know what you mean. Yeah.
they do a, like a word cloud
That's it.
thing.
Yeah.
It has the one that's mentioned most is a big word, and the ones that
Yeah.
and you can do them in
That's it.
shapes. And there's all sorts
Yeah.
of programs that will do that at the touch of a button. If you just feed in a list of
Yeah.
words, you could feed in all the words while you're doing the prayers, and somebody could produce a word cloud. And then at the end, you could produce a second word cloud, and then put the word clouds next to each other to see
See what had
visually
changed. Yeah.
what's changed, what's now the biggest
Yeah.
word, and what was the biggest word, or
Yeah.
something like that. I don't know.
And
That would work.
why?
And why?
Yeah.
Yeah, the
Yeah.
only idea is I'm going to have children in the congregation, so I'd have to do something. The only I had one idea that's kind of just a really based on a weak pun about holiness. That's just to get loads of stuff with holes in, stuff that should have holes in, like a colander, for instance. And a watering can spout, because I'd have that from last week, still there. And they're useless without the holes. And then I'd have stuff that shouldn't have holes in, like an umbrella, maybe some clothing, ex exercising caution about where the hole
Yeah.
is. Stuff that shouldn't have holes in, and then talk about holiness and how that's not the kind of holiness we're talking about, but. How
So
is
you'll be
holiness
bringing your
used?
string vest then.
String vest, yes,
Yeah.
that'll be perfect. So stuff. So what is useful about holiness, and lead it into what is holiness? And I think I'd try to define holiness, perhaps not with the world's best definition or the most accurate, but it would be something like that old Ready Brick advert. If I'd maybe get a picture of that, they used to have a Ready Brick advert where you'd eat your Ready Brick in the morning. And then you'd go out in the world with this kind of luminous shape around you. Do you remember
Yeah.
that? So
Yeah, I do.
they must still exist on YouTube.
Yeah.
Holiness is being able to go out into the world and yet keep not a shield, because that's you're not shielding off the
No.
world, but keep
Yeah.
something of the radiant glow of God's presence with you as you go out
Yeah.
into the world. That's what holiness is. So that would be one. The other one would be focusing more on the what goes into the mouth, because that's always exciting with children. I think I might have some food that children might not normally like. I might even buy some insects. You can get bags of chocolate covered locusts, for instance.
Yum.
And you could get a load of those.
Yeah.
You get people to eat them, and then they could say, "Are you a worse person now that you've eaten that? Has that changed who you are now you've eaten that? It might have been horrible, but does that mean you're more horrible because you've eaten it?" And I haven't really thought that through completely, but there must be some way of linking that into
Yeah, you
holiness
don't
and
want to
what
go
goes.
down the path of saying, are you more horrible than you already were?
Yep, could
That's
do.
not very affirming.
I think I'll resist, and there are people who would be proud of me for doing so, but I will resist the other end of Jesus's quotation, which is also a route you could go down if you really wanted to. But I will resist that one. So there we go. I think that's as much as I've got to offer. Have you got anything
And
else
me,
burning?
no, that's my offering for this week.
Marvelous. Thank you, Peter. Two old blokes deal with the Bible. What more could you want?
We
we
should
we've
go
been
fishing and launch a television program.
Yes, we should. All we need is beer. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So We've been talking absolute worship for probably a bit less than an hour, I'd imagine. And we hope that maybe just one thing that we've said, likely, probably what Peter has said, will give you an idea for preaching or for helping your congregation get to grips with some of these readings that will bring life and depth to their Christian faith. And we're going to be doing that too. That's why we do this. And I'd assume that the only reason you're here is because Sunday's approaching and that task is very much on your mind. So we are going to pray with you for a moment while we set about that task. Loving God, we give you thanks for these words which we wrestle with. Help us to put them alongside everything else that we know, our life's experiences, our knowledge, our wisdom, the pastoral relationship that we have with our congregations, our prayer life as we speak to you, that through that whole process of encounter and reflection and wrestling, we might have something to offer our congregations that brings life and health and hope and joy. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.